We are channels for energy. I believe that, you know, when you think about the spirit that's animating our bodies, like, I don't think we have enough appreciation for, you know, we identify with these, the costumes that we're wearing, and Madeline looks a certain way and James looks a certain way, but we're both animated by a spirit, which is an individualized expression of source creation.
You're listening to the Madeline Moon Show, a dating and relationship podcast that will bloom open your wild expression, deepen your emotional range, and expand your capacity for mythic love. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Madeline Moon Podcast. Today, we are speaking with my friend and brother, James McCrae, who is an author, meme poet, and teacher, who empowers creators to live with purpose and turn imagination into reality. He's the founder of Sunflower Club, a global community dedicated to creativity as a tool for personal healing and social transformation. Welcome to the podcast, my brother.
Madeline, so nice to see you. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm so happy to have you here. You know, you're one of the few people I call my brother.
Oh, that's such an honor.
Yes, you're definitely a brother. It's like we haven't spent too much time being able to dive deep, like one-on-one, but I feel this really sweet soul connection with you.
I feel the same way. You're absolutely my sister. I feel like we were friends even before we met in real life.
Yeah.
And now that we're friends in real life, it's only become that much more evident that we are brother and sister.
I feel that way for sure. I'm so happy to have you here for so many reasons. You are one of those people who, the minute you step into your world, your meme world, your book world, your podcast world, like the multiple worlds that you have created, it feels like you in your own way in what you create are a muse. Mm. You know, you're a muse to those who create. It's like seeing what you create helps people step into that portal of what's possible for them. There's only a few people I know who are like that. When you enter their space, it's like, oh my God, look at all the things I can make. I can make that. I can do that. I can do memes. Like, you're the embodiment of, here are all the art tools. You know what I'm saying? And I really love that about you.
That's such a sweet thing to say. I've never actually thought about that before, about me being a muse, because I really love the idea of me listening to the muse to find inspiration. And if I can channel that energy through me and let the muse, or the, you know, just the spirit of creativity speak through me, and so other people can find that muse through me, then that would be an honor of a place to be.
I think that makes so much sense, though, because you are, I was reading this morning, I was reading through your book, The Art of You, and I love the pieces that you've written on the muse. And I thought about that today. I was like, that's so interesting, you know, what one pays attention to and is devoted to and worships, in a sense, like they are the transmission of that. So I was thinking about you as a muse in the creative land before I was even reading that. So it makes a lot of sense, because you tend to it. You take time to show gratitude to it, to create space for it.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's like there's an embodiment piece that you have around the muse.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, words are funny, because the muse is one word that can be used to describe the spirit of inspiration. And, you know, that particular word I use because it has kind of a spiritual essence to it, but it doesn't have religious connotations. You know, when I say the muse, I'm really referring to that channel of intuition that connects us with ideas, inspiration, insight that's beyond the reach of the conscious mind. And I think some people could call that God, if you're religiously inclined. You know, some people could call it your higher self. Some people call it the Galactic Federation, and they're channeling interdimensional
the Galactic Federation
beings. What I'm saying is that the all forms of channeling are a way of opening your portal of intuition to receive ideas and insights beyond the reach of the conscious mind. And I think it's spiritual by nature, because we really are tapping into other dimensions to receive insight. And so many times my best ideas just pop into my head and it's hard for me to take credit for them. What I can take credit for is cultivating my own channel of intuition and keeping that portal open and being receptive to the voice of the muse, right? But I can't take credit for the actual idea. So for me, it really is a spiritual practice. I think creativity is a spiritual practice because when you're tapping into another dimension to receive an insight, and then you're using the power of your creativity to bring that insight into reality in some physical form, in whatever that form that takes, you know, what could be more spiritual than that? I feel like it's a, it's an aspect of bringing heaven to earth in a very literal sense. You know, we're receiving the ideas from somewhere else, and then we're building them and creating them and sharing them. It's us being portals for the divine. So for me, that is a sacred relationship. And that's why my creative practice, I do try to really cultivate a environment that's going to attract the muse, you know, and that's both my own inner environment, you know, cultivating my own inner presence, you know, my own consciousness, and also making sure I'm in a clean environment, you know, beautiful music playing, and, you know, having a, cultivating a space that the muse feels safe to visit. Because if there's too much clutter and activity in the mind or around you, it can be hard to really channel that voice of the muse. So that's my main job as an artist and as a writer, is to cultivate a space where the muse feels safe to visit.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about the internal, like cultivating an embodiment of peace and space, and also the external. And I think that the external piece, I mean both, but I think the external piece can be really undervalued about how the space that you live in needs to be clean, organized. Like there is a lot of deep value into having your lifestyle, the items in your home being really important, having things in their home, in the home, like everything having a place. You know, some people really thrive on clutter and messes, but I feel like the home is a deep reflection of like the space and the container you create for the muse to enter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it works both ways. I think that, you know, often if I clean my room, then I'll feel a sense of, you know, just inner order and organization. And if I meditate and if I, you know, take care of my consciousness, then I'll also want my room to be clean, just because I'm in that place. So, you know, I think it depends. You know, I think that also I like to say that you can work with whatever you have. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's art that exists across every facet of society. And, you know, some people don't live in environments that are conducive to having a clean room, honestly, or just living in it with a place of inner peace, right? And there's examples of art throughout history. I look at the paintings of Jean-Michel Basquiat, which are messy and scribbles and just like really kind of chaotic, because he was living in New York City and he was homeless for a time and he was a drug addict, but he was able to take all those pieces around him and transmute them into beauty, even though it was a chaotic, messy type of beauty. But certainly if you you know, being an artist and trying to create with intention and with purpose, and to really harness that energy, I do think it's best to have a clean space, have a clean mind, so you just have more autonomy over the process.
Yeah, Yeah, thank you for making that point. I think that's a really beautiful, yeah, because sometimes like having a clean space is not in the cards for everybody, mm-hmm. you know? And does that mean you can't have art or right. you can't have the best art, the most beautiful art?
Right.
No. Okay, I want to get back into the creativity, and also I want to slip in a little bit of your story mm-hmm. because I find your story really amazing. Like, you know, I don't think that you were really shown this way from your childhood. And I just would love to hear, like, you know, you grew up and you really carved the creative path for yourself. And I want your story. Give us your story.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I think that every artist has to carve the path for themselves. And every leader, every innovator kind of has to find that way for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's even why I've always refused to read the Artist's Way.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love knowing that.
Because I'd rather
you.
Just try to live the Artist's Way and discover it for myself.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the best, no matter what you're doing in life, the best way to get there is to go out on a journey. Mm-hmm. So I think we don't even know what's best for us sometimes. Because so many times we grow up and we have different ideas planted in our heads about what we should be or what we should do. And we can follow those external, you know, markers, or we can see life as an adventure and as a journey. And you embark on that journey and you really see where it leads you. Mm-hmm. And it's really the journey along the way that makes you who you are. Mm-hmm. And then when you arrive, it's going to be a more authentic, embodied, earned sense of wisdom. So, yeah, I grew up in a really small town in Southwest Minnesota. And I mean, very small. Like up until I was 10, I lived in a town of like a couple hundred people. Mm. And,
Wow, that is a very tiny town.
Very tiny town. But, you know, luckily there was a lot of kids my age, so I had a lot of friends, despite how small the town was. And it was honestly a great environment for cultivating creativity. Because I feel like so many kids these days, they grow up in, whether it's the city or wherever it is, and either they're living in some place that's unsafe, so they have to be afraid and they can't, you know, be free to run around on their own, or there's also so much pressure to get into the right school, even mm-hmm. like getting into the right elementary school. Mm-hmm. Kids are already like taking tests and like really trying to, you know, fit into the academic system rather than exploring their own interests and curiosities and creativities. Mm-hmm. So I was blessed to have plenty of space to roam, both with my imagination and also just roam around the fields and surrounding my where I lived. We would wander down the railroad tracks and just make up imaginary scenarios and stories. And just, I had a lot of space to be creative. And my parents, you know, supported that. So I was always drawing and writing. And it was, I think I was in my early teens when I discovered poetry. I think my mom had like poetry books laying around the house. Mm. Some of the classics. So like as a kid, I was really drawn to like Edgar Allan Poe was my first favorite because it rhymes and it's kind of mm-hmm. like, it's easy for a kid maybe to to like. And then I started writing poetry. And
do you still have some of your first pieces?
I have some. There was a time when I went home, I was visiting home, and I had, you know, stacks of notebooks filled with old poems. And I intentionally threw away a bunch of these notebooks.
Wow, why?
Because I just wanted to start fresh.
Yeah.
Not that I was ever going to show them or publish them or anything, but just energetically letting go of that past and be like, I'm only looking forward mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an energetic release.
That's a good note for people just because like I have a closet full of journals and I'm like, what do I do with you? Do I want to keep you? Do I not? And it's kind of like you need a Marie Kondo your journals too.
Absolutely. Exactly. I still have a bunch now, but they're from recent years, not from my, but I saved a few. But I started writing poetry and I just wrote poetry all the time. It really became an outlet for me as a teen to express myself and to, I just found it to be poetry. You could speak a language that you couldn't speak otherwise.
Were you an angsty teen at all? Were you, I wrote poetry when I was young and it was very sad, sort of sad, but yours was like introspective and...
Yeah, introspective. There were probably some love poems to girls I went to school with. You know, I was writing, like, I was so weird. Like, I was writing poems about, like, the Civil War.
Wow.
And, like, it just, it's a way to just, writing poetry is just a way to navigate the landscape of emotion in a way that you don't get a chance to in regular life, especially as, like, a teenage boy.
Beautifully said.
You know? So I really got to explore my own inner world through reading and writing poetry. And you just kind of map the terrain of your emotions. So I wasn't angsty, but yeah, I was, you know, every teen is angsty to a degree or sad to a degree. And I'm sure I had whatever problems I had at the time that seem, you know, silly looking back on. But no, before I turned 20, I probably wrote, I mean, hundreds of poems.
Wow.
Which is so good because people, you know, often ask me how to, you know, how to be a good writer. And it's like, if I hadn't written, I can confidently say that I'm a good writer now because I've spent so many hours through my life writing. You know, it's the Malcolm Gladwell rule about to master anything, all you need to do is put in 10,000 hours of practice.
That's right.
You know, you can't shortcut that practice. It doesn't matter if you're a gifted, naturally gifted person. It's that practice, that repetition, that muscle memory that really develops your skills. So, and also I was experimenting with style. Like I would find new poets or new influences. Like when I found the beat poets who include people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac in like 1950s New York City, which is a much more modern, raw type of poetry than the stuff I was used to. So then I would, as I discovered new influences, I would absorb them and change my style and experiment. So I was not just writing poetry. I was really experimenting with form and technique, trying different voices out. And the jazz musician Miles Davis has a great quote where he said, "Sometimes it takes a long time to sound like yourself."
Beautiful.
So I feel like through all of these trying on different costumes and trying on different voices and trying different techniques, I gradually found a voice that was my own. And at the same time, I was really interested in visual arts. I've always been balancing the visual arts and writing. So I got into painting in my like late teens, then I wanted to be a painter. And even I went to, you know, my friends were going to college and I didn't want to, I didn't know what to do. But I went to college because I felt like I had to, and I hated it, and I just wanted to create and write and paint. So I dropped out after a semester, and I gave myself a year just to wander around the country. I was living in random places and working odd jobs and just developing my skills as a painter and as a writer. And that was great, but I also got depressed doing that because I had really gone off on my own. You know, I wasn't in college. I was, I didn't have direction. I was being creative, but I didn't have purpose. So I decided I need to have more direction with my creativity. And that's when I decided to go to a design school. So I went to design school in Minneapolis and I learned how to apply my creativity to, in this case, advertising and graphic design. So I got my foot in the door. I say I snuck into the business world through the back door as an artist. So I began working in graphic design and had a 10-year career in advertising.
Wow, it's 10 years.
First as a few years as a graphic designer, but then I was interested in brand strategy, which is more like high-level thinking. And doing brand messaging and things like that. So I moved to New York City, was working on Madison Avenue as a brand strategist. And yeah, that's, and like I wrote my first book while I was working full time in advertising, living in New York, which was then returning back to my own creative expression rather than in advertising, you know, working. I was being creative, but it was always for someone else. So it was better than a corporate job, but I still wasn't fully fulfilled by it. So then writing my own, you know, my first book, Shit Your Ego Says, I wrote it while I was working in advertising. And that was kind of a return back to, you know, my own creative expression.
I remember seeing that book everywhere. Like I remembered, I knew the cover before I knew who you were. I met you. Like I just could so distinctly see the cover. And I remember because I would, you know, I used to do these very often Barnes and Noble rituals. Like I grew up going to Barnes and Noble every single Sunday with my family. That was our ritual, was to go get pizza and then go to Barnes and Noble and have like a book day, big book family. And I just continue that on through my life. But I remember when your cover, like, you know, hit the shelves, it was just everywhere. It was just so successful. Like, and hearing that you were in a completely different life at that time, and you were able to doing advertising, create enough space to write a book. Like anyone who's written a book knows how much devotion and dedication that takes. And that must have been like, I'm imagining that that was a peak of like fullness in life, like doing this advertising job and then also creating all the space for this craft that you're working on.
Yeah, it was a lot. You know, living in New York is demanding regardless, you know, and I think people are kind of running on fumes in New York, but it's usually because people are out, you know, drinking and partying and things like that and also working. For me, like people ask me like, you know, how can you balance, you know, having a career in advertising and writing a book? And the truth is that writing a book is like the most fun thing I can do. So I don't even like to get up early, but I would get up extra early so I would have time to write before going to work. And for me, it's because that's so fun, like the exploration and the curiosity and the, because I treat it like play and I treat it like my life story where it's like going on a journey. So when I'm writing a book, I'm so interested in that process of discovery. Like, I love the idea that you can sit down with a notebook and you don't even know what's going to come out. You know what I mean? Like, there are things that we quote from books from hundreds of years ago, like Shakespeare, let's say. Like, one day, someone just sat down and wrote that. And then it just, like, lives on forever through the collective consciousness. And I just love that idea of, what's going to come out of me today? You know, what am I going to give voice to today? And for me, that's a fun process of discovery. I don't put a lot of pressure on it. So it restores my energy rather than taking it away. So I would wake up and be excited to write, or I would get home and maybe pour some wine and be excited to write some more or edit what I wrote. So making it fun and making it a journey of discovery makes it so much more easy to do.
So I want to get a little bit into the creative process, and I'm having all these questions that are like popping up as you're talking. So I might like ping pong around a little bit. I'm curious what you have to say about the, you know, there's the aspect of writing a book. And how many have you written now? Three?
I've published three books.
Three books, but many, probably written more.
There's some that are in development. Yeah. Let's just say that.
So published three books, which is huge. And, you know, like everyone's publishing journey is different. Everyone has different publishing karma that they have to go through. My karma with book writing has not been easeful. And I think that, you know, Artist of Love, it was, I went into it like, this is happening. So I'm going to self-publish it because no one's going to tell me no. There's no gatekeepers. Like I just karate chopped them all away. I was like, this is happening. So Artist of Love was a success. And yet there's still so much like energy around the, even post-publishing Artist of Love, there's still a lot of exhaustion that I felt because I hired a specific editor that I wanted to give me a traditional publishing experience. Like, I wanted him to take with his red pen and turn it into something that would be something you would publish, you know? Like, I just wanted it to be, to feel very, not the right word, but like official.
Yeah.
Like, even though it's self-published, I want it to feel like a traditional published book.
Yes.
And even that process of the red pen, just like it, you know, it drained me. And like at the beginning, there was this, okay, yeah, give it to me, boss. Lay it on me, like dom me, daddy. Like, I was excited about the red pen. And I, you know, it was probably part of my bodybuilding days and the personal training days when the guy like took a pen to my body and was like, you need to work on these parts.
Right.
And it gave me like, yeah, tell me all the things about me that suck. And I went into the book writing process of like, make me better, put me in, coach. But by the end of it, I was feeling a little bit resentful because of their opinions. Great editor, but also like, I started to lose pieces of the poetic nature of the book. My first draft, I think you maybe read, I don't know if you read the first version, because I had a first version, or you read the, maybe you read the more towards the one of the one that got published.
I don't remember, but I read one of them.
Which is so sweet of you to do. But the first version that I wrote that book within, I think a month. 2 weeks, maybe. I wrote the full book in 2 weeks.
That's incredible. Takes me a lot longer.
I wrote that one in 2 weeks. I once wrote a 300-page book memoir about the men I've dated, which I think I told you about that. And then I just put it in a file because it was so daunting and overwhelming of like, okay, I've got all this raw material. Mm-hmm. What do I do with it now? So what I'm getting at is finding your unique voice in writing is a skill in itself. And then there is the process of editing. How does one who relates to my story of feeling a little confused in the editing process, how does one keep continuing moving forward with writing things if there's a little bit of resentment, like, oh, I'm going to write this whole thing, but then I'm going to have to edit it all, and it's not going to be the pure transmission of what I originally had. Some of that's like, you just got to like, you know, clean and clear the resentment. But also there's the practical side of it. Like, you will have to take pieces out. How do you go into that willingly, mm-hmm, without sacrificing some important pieces of what's yes, important to you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, let me start by just saying a little bit about my publishing journey. Because, mm-hmm, as you said, everyone has different, I love how you put that, publishing karma.
Yeah.
And it's so true. Mm-hmm. Because some people get published very easy. Mm-hmm. Some people it takes a lot longer, and it's not always fair. It's never fair. It has to do with so many factors. It has to do with where you are, the position you're in, who you know, and just the right person seeing your manuscript or your proposal at the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, your book easily could have been published by a traditional publisher. Just with the right people seeing it. You know, my first book, you know, I'll just go through this quickly because it's a long story, but I had no business publishing my first book. I had no audience whatsoever. Hmm. And it had to do with me moving to New York, because after I moved to New York, shortly after I arrived, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, mm-hmm, and it destroyed my apartment and I became homeless.
Wow.
And I ended up, my friend invited me to live, to crash for a while on this little island in the Caribbean called Culebra. And I didn't have a job, because I moved to New York without a job. I didn't have a place to live, didn't have much money. Mm. And I'm on this little island after a hurricane, and I didn't know what to do. And I felt like a failure, because I had like taken a lot of risks to move to New York City. Mm. And I sat on the beach. There's this, you know, empty beach that I would sit on every day and just watch the tide come in and out, and I'd be in a state of meditation. And I felt like a failure. I felt like I had made a mistake moving to New York. And the longer I sat with my own mind, I started to recognize that, like, that's just my ego talking. Mm. And the longer I sat, I would recognized this voice of my intuition, which was telling me that everything was unfolding for a purpose, even though I couldn't see that purpose quite yet. Mm. And then I had this insight that, oh, wow, I'm going to write a book about this insight, and it's going to be called Shit Your Ego Says. And I kind of just felt like this was the book that was going to get published, but I still didn't have a publisher. I didn't have any, I didn't have an audience whatsoever. And I ended up making a proposal, and I sent it out to every email that I could find in the publishing world, agents, editors, you name it. And I got no responses. Like they didn't even bother to reject me. I just got no responses.
Oh, it's the worst.
And I had sent it to a friend, and he had some contacts with like the Hay House UK office. And without telling me, he just kind of sent it along. And then they loved it, and they sent it to the New York office, and they loved it. And then before I know what's happening, I get invited into the Hay House offices for a meeting. And she tells me, we love your proposal. If you had an audience, we would publish this tomorrow, but you need to work on growing your audience. And I'm like, okay, great. I guess I'll go back to the drawing board. And then the next day she emailed me and she's like, listen, we have this conference coming up in Chicago, and it's like $10,000 to attend. And someone who attends is going to win a publishing contract. Wow. And we're going to send you there for free. So they sent me to this conference, and I ended up winning the contest.
What?
And then I was gifted the book proposal for my first book.
Aww.
Or the contract for my first book.
That's amazing.
So it was completely untraditional, and it took, it took a lot of life experience for that to happen. And then I got really lucky. So it can be frustrating, but then things can happen when you least expect them also.
Mm-hmm.
So just sticking with it, I still have, everyone's got a different publishing journey for sure. So when it comes to editing, first of all, I enjoy the editing process myself. Because,
how? Yeah.
Well, this is why.
Yeah, I want to know, like, how do you get there to enjoying that?
Well, because that is where my ego gets to come out and shine.
Yes, I feel this.
Because I feel like the creative process is, there's two different stages, and we can go into them in more detail, but there's like the yin and the yang stages of creativity. And for me, the yin is about being receptive to the voice of the muse and opening your channel of intuition and letting things flow through you. And to do that effectively, you need to get the ego out of the way. The ego is that critical mind that's trying to judge and evaluate and compare. And I just tell my ego, this is not your time and place. You're going to get your chance to look it all over. But my ego knows, if my ego wants validation, it knows it needs to get out of the way and let my intuition do its work, because it's going to be better in the long run if it gets out of the way. So I make my ego a deal, and I say, listen, this isn't your time. You'll get your chance later. And then I go into that, you can call it channeling, that downloading ideas and letting things flow through you. And then you do that enough to have like, let's say you have a book chapter. Then I'm like, okay, ego, let's fact check all of this. Let's make sure it's all good. And then really to edit. And honestly, the more I write and the more I really tune into that intuition, the less I need to edit. Because it kind of comes through more clear, more precise. But there's this great, there's a line in the book where it's something like, create without judgment, edit without mercy. So once you're in the editing phase, it's kind of like, we're talking about creating a space, like an environment. It's kind of like when you're writing, it's almost like, buying furniture or decorations for your house. You're kind of filling it with stuff. But then the editing is where you organize it and say, this goes here, this goes here. I like this piece, but there's not a place for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be willing to remove the things that there's not a place for. Like there's some writer used the phrase, kill your darlings. And to be a good editor, you have to be willing to kill your darlings. Mm-hmm. There might be a line that you love, but if it just doesn't end up working, you need to be okay cutting it out. And ultimately, less is more. And simplicity,
that is so true.
Simplicity communicates better than complexity or things that are over, have embellishments or flourishments. Sometimes stripping away those embellishments and flourishments lead to more mm-hmm. clarity and precision. And, you know, different artists and writers inspire me in different ways. And one of my writing influences and my favorite writers is Joan Didion. Joan Didion was a journalist and she wrote books and novels. And her writing is so clean and so precise. So I learned a lot about writing from her, not in terms of subject matter or the poetry of it, but like how to construct a sentence, how to end a paragraph, mm-hmm. little things like that. So in my editing process, I almost feel like I have Joan Didion looking over my shoulder, being like, you could probably do away with that. Mm-hmm. Or like, there's a quote in the book, the example from the fashion designer Coco Chanel, who was very into, you know, she was a minimalist kind of French fashion designer. And she had a rule of thumb for getting dressed and going out. She's like, just put on everything that you want to wear. And then before you leave the house, look in the mirror and take off one thing. Mm. So you're erring on the side of simplicity.
Yeah.
So for me, I like that clarity. I like that simplicity. So I haven't had that red pen that you mentioned with the editor going through your work and changing it. I haven't had editors do a lot of dissecting of my books. And with my new book, with Art of You, I really trusted them. Because even I had a different title.
You did? Can we know what it was?
It was Creativity Cheat Codes.
Oh.
And I had a really hard time letting go of that title.
Yeah.
When they said, you want to change, I was just attached to it. Mm. And they're like, yeah, but it's about more than just cheat codes for creativity. It's about more than just making art. It's about living as art,
yeah.
Right? And it's like the Art of You is just a much more broad and accessible title for more people. And that hurt at first, but I really decided I'm going to trust them. This is a collaboration. They've published way more books than I will ever publish in a lifetime, no matter how long I live and how many books I write. Like mm-hmm. this is what they do. So I have to trust them. And there were also, I had a whole third section of the book that they wanted to cut. And that was tough because some of my favorite chapters were in that. Because that's when it got really into not just making art and being creative, but how art impacts culture and how you can make a social impact with your creativity.
Which is one of my favorite things that you talk about, because it really reframes social media, you know, at the bare minimum, like it really reframes social media rather than it's just this, our world is turning to this online platform and online this and online that. And instead, like, oh my gosh, we have the power of the online world, online this and online that. Yes. Like it's just this excitement. And you really, you know, I remember when you did this. You did a small offering of the meme class for my program, Creativity and Love, because I was so inspired by that, of like, what's possible? And then I had them all create. We work on different, every student gets an Artist of Love stage name, and it's like her embodiment that she's coming out into the world as. And there's all sorts of names that we come with: Waking in Wonder, Squirting Starlight, Lakshmi's Milk and Honey Tits, like all sorts of things.
Love it.
And I had them all make a meme out of it. Like they watched the class and then they made some meme their coming out meme. And it was our last project of the year and it was so fun. Sorry, I'm interrupting you. But I just wanted to say that is, you know, something that you teach that's so valuable and important.
Yeah, thank you. They wanted to get rid of the whole last section of the book. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing was I ended up salvaging some of it and integrating it other places in the book. And actually, I think it is better in the way that it landed. So I think it's just important to trust your editor and to listen to them, and also to push back. You know, there were some things that they wanted me to cut that I didn't cut, and they were fine with that. But, you know, I'm in my collaboration phase where I don't want to be the one, you know, I don't want to be the lone genius or the lone artist who's like out there trying to be this like rugged individual-ish. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that like our culture doesn't need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I trust the collaboration process, and I'm willing to sacrifice my own ego for something that's going to be better in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I think that there is a lot of trust that is involved in trying things, like testing things, seeing how things land. I think as we've been talking, I realized that the thing for me that is the hardest about the editing is not making a good sentence great, because I'm down for that. I want that. Mm-hmm. It's the transitions and the mess.
Mm.
When I go into like a Google Doc and there's all these comments and notes.
Yeah.
And pieces highlighted.
Yeah.
And they're different colors.
Yeah.
And it's like, this piece needs to go to section 3, da da da. And it's just messy. And it's like, oh my gosh, where's the order? I want all the order. It's not about the final product for the sake of the final product. It's the final product because the final product has everything we're supposed to be. And I think it has something to do with my brain. Like, just because, you know, things being out of order, even in my home, are like nails on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
So I think that's really the most challenging piece for me. It's not so much about like, how do we reword this? Because that is a challenge that actually feels a little fun. It's more so that it needs to move and it's not there yet. And it's like my job to perfectly place it where it's supposed to go. It's a lot of pressure.
I know what you mean. I remember seeing like the Word document come back to me with all of these like notes and edits, and it just looks jarring because it's like they've butchered my poetry in a way.
Mm.
So it's, you know, that's just like, that's just part of the process, you know,
sitting in the mess.
Yeah. The process is not always pretty, especially like when it comes to creating the final book. You know, there's parts of it that are all flow and that you're just in that zone. And that's probably your favorite place to be while writing. It's my favorite place to be while writing.
So good. Drinking that glass of wine and just like.
But I guess it's like relationships, you know, it's like there are parts of relationships that are the yummy parts where it's just like love and devotion. And just, you feel like you're so in it and in devotion to each other. And then there are parts that are messy that you have to work through. So I guess it's sort of like that to bring it back to some themes that you talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, you know, it's not really devotion if it doesn't include sticking with it through those pieces that are challenging.
Yes.
Relationship. Oh my gosh. Okay. I would love to hear your story of how you met Britta.
Oh, easy. Tinder. Did you know that?
Yes, I knew
that. You knew that. Yeah.
And I love it so much. I love it so much. I love when I hear that couples met on Tinder, just because there's so much, you know, it was years ago, but still it's like there's so much judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I think around the story of how people meet and like the story needs to be. Have you ever read the book A Course of Love or A Course on Love?
No.
Oh, you would love this. Mm. Alain de Botton.
Okay.
It's like this story about love mixed with, it's like it's fiction, but it's mixed with so much poetry. It is beautiful. I'm going to have to go back and read it now that I'm talking about it. It's so good. But anyways, he talks about in the book this big theme, which is that most people think the love story is how did you meet?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I just asked you that, so I'd be a hypocrite if, you know, if I'm saying that question isn't fun. But it's not that. It's everything that follows after.
Oh, yeah.
Everything that follows after, and the how you meet story is like, you know, the precursor to all of the love.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the universe works in mysterious ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the universe will use any tool at its disposal to make its plan come into order. You know, you could meet at a party, or you can meet through the internet. You could meet on Instagram, or there are so many ways you can meet someone. And it's just like, these are all just, you know, God works through the internet as much as they work through, you know, other channels, mm-hmm. right? So, but it is, I mean, definitely Tinder is definitely, especially in New York City, it's a bit of a needle in the haystacks sort of
and
situation.
Y'all find each other. I'm curious what y'all's like intro little conversation was like when who pinged who, if we even remember that, what your conversation.
Well, it was funny because we were both going through a really big phase because the week we met on Tinder was the same week that my book came out. Mm. And it was the same week that she opened her first studio in New York City.
Wow.
So we had both just taken this big professional leap. Mm. And then within days, we met on Tinder. So it was kind of like we were both in that same place. And then we came into each other's lives. Mm. And I do remember, because I remember on Tinder, not that I was going on a million Tinder dates, but I was going on some. And I was very careful not to commit to like a dinner, because with online dating, you really, when you meet someone in person, you're really going to know within the first 5 or 10 minutes whether there's any chance, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because there's just the in-person dynamics is so different than the curated online pictures that people have.
Right.
So I was always like, well, maybe let's meet for a coffee or a drink, something low stakes that you can leave within a half an hour if you need to. Mm-hmm. But I remember being like, listen, I don't usually ask people to dinner, but do you want to go to dinner with me? Because I felt strong about her and our connection. Mm-hmm. So we went, it was middle of winter. We went to dinner in like lower Manhattan. And it was just so easy and effortless. It was just easy, effortless. Mm-hmm. Like it just felt like normal, natural, and easy. And we ended up hanging out again the next day and the next day and the next day. I think we saw each other like the next 10 days.
Aww.
And it wasn't because we were just like so madly, like it wasn't like this passionate, like I need to see you. It was just easy. It just like, no, I want to be with her. Mm-hmm. It just feels good. So, and then honestly, within 2 months, we were living together.
Wow.
Which was my first time living with a partner. So it was like, it escalated very quickly.
What was that like? Like adjusting to living together with someone for the first time?
Well, we found this beautiful apartment in Nolita, but with like a place like Nolita and with our budget, like it was so small. Mm. So we went not only did we move in together, we were living in like an alcove, one bedroom, basically like a studio apartment. So it was close quarters very quickly. Mm-hmm. And maybe we had a few arguments here and there, but we coexist really well. We share space really well. One of the reasons I think we do that is because we both give each other enough space to be ourselves and to do our thing without putting too much pressure on getting things from each other, or like we're both life path sevens, and I don't know, like that's kind of like the it's kind of like the loner. We both kind of need our alone time. Mm-hmm. So we're really good at just sharing space, being together, but also giving each other the freedom we need to be alone, to be ourselves without putting too much pressure on the relationship. Mm. So we've always coexisted very well.
So what's your perspective on needs in relationship? It sounds like y'all walk that, mm-hmm. that line very well between like you have needs in relationship, and as partners, it's one of the gifts we can bring into love. And then also I so hear you on like not pulling at like, mm-hmm. you know, going into that place of like mm-hmm. high demand. How have y'all learned? Sounds like it's always kind of been there, but if you could mm-hmm. pull out any pieces of wisdom with that, mm-hmm. What would you offer to people who feel like they're kind of stuck in the needs area and relationship, and how to like really self-source?
Yeah, you know, for me, it's like, I've personally had to learn, you know, to be attentive to her needs.
Mm.
And, you know, to treat, you know, if she's happy, the relationship is going to be happy and I'm going to be happy. Mm-hmm. So, and what I learned is, like, for us, I'm just speaking for us, little things can go such a long way.
Mm.
You know, just like making sure she's, honestly, like making sure she's hydrated, like bring her tea in the morning, you know, just little things to make sure she's okay and taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So just making that a part of my own daily hygiene is, you know, making sure she has what she needs.
Mm.
That has just created a more solid relationship and helped me grow, in the process. So, and I feel like there's not a lot of neediness, you know, between us. Like, I feel like I tend to be self-sufficient. So we just flow with it, to be perfectly honest. You know, we just flow with it, and it just, like, in each moment I try to be present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been like a journey of our relationship is me deepening in my own presence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even, you know, as you know, we have a baby on the way.
Yes.
This is our first.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be easy to project into the future and start to plan and worry about what's going to happen when the baby arrives. But for me, I've gone even more deep into being present in each moment, because I realize that the more present I am in each moment now, and the more I'm able to take care of whatever I need to take care of in that moment. Mm. And I just remain present. Well, when that baby arrives, I'll be ready for that moment.
Yeah.
Because I'm just focusing on one moment at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And not projecting into the future, not worrying about what happened in the past, but just treating each moment like it's new, not holding on to resentments, you know, not letting anxiety about the future get in the way.
Mm.
But it's been a mindfulness practice for me.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show up every day as best I can.
Mm. I am, like, so grateful to be Britta's friend during this time. We have, for everyone listening, we have a little girl friend group that is very tight-knit. And this is our first hour. baby in our girlfriend group.
It is.
Which is nuts. I don't know. I think it's nuts. Like, at this point where most of us are early to late 30s, mm-hmm. some, you know, mid-40s, some 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And this is our first baby in the group. So we're all very excited to be pregnant. Well,
I'm honored to have all the aunties from y'all.
That baby is going to be so loved.
So much sass.
Yeah. And there's already in our group just like, okay, who's going to be here during the summer so that, like, we can, like, support and help. And yeah,
well, we're both grateful to have all
y'all.
Yeah,
we're so happy.
And your support.
Yeah, we're so happy for y'all. So, okay, another question that I wanted to ask. Kind of, I'll tie this into where we're at now and then back into creativity land. One of the things that I've experienced, this happened like a month ago, where, and I'm still kind of in that where I'm realizing I need a nice thick break from doing.
Yes.
It's really hard for me. I just finished teaching this like incredible immersion called Unbound. It was the most successful like weekend I've held. I'm excited to do another one. But mm-hmm. besides that, like, there's nothing else going on.
Mm-hmm.
My group programs have stopped. I'm not making anything. And I really want to, like, actually, that's not true. I am making a course and a program. But besides this,
we can't help it.
You know, we can't help it. I'm actually building so much right now. I just wrote a 65-page outline for this program. But anyways. But
other than that, nothing
else. But in like the meta, I'm really trying to take the other pockets of space to rest and like not feel like I need to like create. Even though I'm creating, I don't want to have the energetic of having to create.
Yes.
Which is very hard for me for years and years. It's, you know, since I was probably a kid, I've really been in some kind of vortex. And before this new course idea that I'm working on came forward, I was really in the nothingness. And I was feeling very humdrum, feeling really humdrum. And then I was going into some like crying fits, just like, who am I? You know, I was really coming face to face what I'm not doing or making or creating. What is my purpose? Yeah. Who am I? What am I doing? I couldn't orient myself. And then I had this idea come, and now I'm a little more sunshiny because yes. I'm working on something. My question in all of this is, what's that about?
Yeah.
That's my question, because creativity is this life force generating act. And it is, yeah, I think it's, I think the piece that I'm saying is that maybe there is a little confusion around the doing and the being.
Yes.
Of creativity, but separating those is very, very hard. How does one find themselves in the being and just stay there for a bit of time?
Yes. It's a great question. And that all resonates with me. You know, I always have projects cooking, multiple at a time, and I find that fun. Mm-hmm. And, creativity doesn't burn me out. But there are parts of the creative process that can be tiresome. And yeah, I mean, at its essence, I think that creativity is a life force that moves through us. Mm-hmm. We are channels for energy. I believe that, when you think about the spirit that's animating our bodies, I don't think we have enough appreciation for... Mm. We identify with these, mm-hmm. the costumes that we're wearing, and Madeline looks a certain way and James looks a certain way, but we're both animated by a spirit,
yeah,
which is an individualized expression of source creation. Mm. Truly. The energy of source creation is animating our bodies and it moves through us. So creativity is our nature. And I think of it imagine the universe is a tree. And each of us are one branch that's coming out of the tree trunk. And then that energy moves through us. And then the art that we make are the leaves and the fruit that sprout from the branch. So it grows from us the same way that we grow from the universe. So I really believe that creativity is our nature. It's a life force that moves through us. And when we suppress that, we're suppressing our own nature. When people aren't creative for years at a time or for decades at a time, there's really a suppression happening of that energy. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean people need to make art or paint or write. It's about living in a way that it is a creative expression. And as you know, relationships can be a form of art, mm-hmm. right? Or I think of the way that our friend Luna hosts dinner parties.
Yes.
It's so artful.
Such an art.
So you can do so many things in an artful way that is allowing you to express your creativity. Mm-hmm. But having a channel for that energy to move through you, it's healing. And I believe that creativity is a healing modality because it's a way to purge that energy from our systems. So I think it's so important to do it. But there are different phases along every creative process, right? I think of and this could be for a book, for a poem, for social media content. The first phase is the first chapter in the book is called The Art of Doing Nothing. Because I think to really become a vessel for inspiration and to get in touch with that creative life force and to really understand what it is that's trying to move through us. The first part of my creative process is just to sit in stillness and listen to my own body, to feel my emotions, to feel the energy that's moving through me, and to see what's trying to be expressed through me. I don't think with my mind, I feel with my body. And when I sit with it long enough, that will eventually manifest as an insight or an idea. So just being in that stillness is essential to receiving the insight for your creative project. But then once that idea is born, that's when you kind of move into the doing aspects of creativity. Hmm. And I really realized this recently that making art is a creation ritual because you're combining the being with the doing, the being the feminine receptivity of listening to the muse and receiving a download, but then turning that into the masculine where you're creating it and doing it and bringing it to life. So that creative process is a microcosm of the yin and the yang of the universe and the balance between the masculine and the feminine polarities. It's bringing those together. And that's how life is created biologically. And that's how art is created within ourselves through that integration. But then, yes, you know, there's less inspiration when it comes to the doing. Like once I have the idea, once I have like, let's see, oh, I'm going to make a meme and it's going to be, here's the premise of it. Then it becomes, to a degree, it's busy work where it's like, okay, I need to go find the image. I need to go in Photoshop. I need to like put it all together. I need to post it. Or in the case of the book, you know, the book has been written, but now I'm out, I'm doing podcasts and I'm doing public speaking and I'm like promoting it. And this is more, it's more productivity, but it's less inspiration in the same way that like writing the book is. So it's a different, the doing is a lot different than the being. And you can get burnt out on just doing.
Yeah.
This is similar to when I worked in advertising. Because I was juggling multiple clients at once. I had tight deadlines. And it's like productivity on overdrive. Just doing. Like the corporate world doesn't give a lot of room for, you know, that being. You know, like we didn't, working in advertising, we didn't have time blocked off for meditation. You know what I'm saying?
I've never had that experience of like working. I had one actual job. It was like 3 months really. Yeah. And then I was like, I'm going to do my own thing. Yeah. And it was working. Yeah. Social media for a little plant protein powder company.
Well, everyone has different career karma as well.
Yeah, different career karma. My karma was very clear when I came forward of what I was.
Great.
You know. But
doing, it's you can feel burnout and you can, you know, there's not as much inspiration there. Like when you're too much in the being, you might be all flow, inspiration. You know, your channel is open. But if you don't have that balance of that doing, then you're going to struggle to launch projects and to, you know, finish things. But if you're all in the doing, you might be productive and get things done, but your work might be lacking in deeper meaning and purpose. So it's really important to have that integration. And for me, it's returning to that being and to stay there for a while without pressure. For me, that's like a playtime. So for me, that might be like creativity without agenda. And for me, that might look like poetry. You know, it's like, I don't have a reason to write this yet. There's no monetary reason to write a poem, but it's a sandbox for play and for experimentation.
What does your poetry writing ritual look like? Like, do you have like a certain space in your house that you go to and you make tea, or do you go out into nature, or you put your headphones on, you have a certain journal you love to use?
It's the same for poetry, for books, for memes, whatever it is. I like to write first thing in the morning because I think that's when the channel is most open.
Like 6 a.m.?
No, it's whenever I get up, which is going to be like 7:30, 8.
Nice. Yes.
Some people do. Like I was talking to my friend Layla Dahlia recently. She gets up at 4 to write.
Wow. She's kids.
No.
She just does.
She calls them the God hours.
I've heard this before.
And that's when she thinks that channel is most clear.
Did she go back to sleep?
I don't know. I didn't ask her.
I have so many questions.
Maybe she has an early bedtime.
So many questions.
Mine is pretty simple. I get up, I make a big pot of yerba mate tea. And I like coffee, but I'll have coffee later in the day. Coffee's more like busy work, get stuff done. But tea is better for that. It's more like, than like an alarm. Like, burp, burp, burp. Coffee's more like an alarm. I start, and then I meditate for like 10 minutes just to, you know, clear my head. And I play some instrumental music, and I've got a notebook that's open, and I just see what's trying to come through me.
Hmm.
Simple as that. And I love poetry because it's so free. Like, some of my poems that were published in my poetry book, I would start writing it without knowing where it was going to go. Like, I remember, like, the first line in a poem was, "It could have been worse. We could have forgotten the wine." Mm. And I had no idea what that line was saying. It could have been worse. We could have forgotten the wine. And then the next line turned out to be, "At least we had something to drink as the sun sank into the Pacific on our last night in Los Angeles."
Mm. I remember this one.
And it turned out to be this like poem about fleeing LA during the apocalypse,
which was
like the COVID thing.
Yeah.
I did publish it.
Yeah.
But something. Like when that first line came through, I did not know. I had no intention of where that was going to go. And it ended up being the perfect line for this story that I ended up writing. Or like one of the poems in my book is called, the title just came to me. And the title I thought was so funny. It was "Watching CNN on Peyote." And I'm like, okay. I'm like, now I have to write a poem about what it would be like to watch CNN on peyote and to have like a comedic, but also kind of like psychedelic and scary. Like, what would it look like to be on? I've never even done peyote, but like imagining what would
terrifying.
Be like to be on psychedelics, yeah. And then watching CNN of all things and just seeing the juxtaposition of that. So the title came to me and I'm like, I guess I have to write this. So it really is like listening and feeling my way through it. And with poetry specifically, I've gotten really good at, it almost feels like I'm taking dictation where, you know, I can edit later, but when the words are coming through, I don't edit them as they're coming through. I let the thought play itself out however it chooses to. And I'm simply writing it down.
Mm-hmm.
And if sometimes it feels uncomfortable, like I don't really know what that is going for, but it always ends up being better. Like one of my favorite poets is Allen Ginsberg. And he was asked, "Do you spend much time polishing your poems?" In other words, editing them. And he said, "No, but I spend a lot of time polishing my mind." So again, it's about cultivating your consciousness so you're a clear channel. So you know, poetry is often it's a purge of your subconscious and just trusting that to come out as it needs to without the ego's interference is how I try to write poetry.
Mm, that's beautiful. I love that. I love your morning ritual.
Yeah.
I wrote, it's funny, as we're talking about this, I forget, you know, we've all lived so many lives. There was a period of my life where I wrote so much poetry in college. It was like end of high school into college. And I started this, I remember my roommate was getting into photography. She was just like, "I got a camera. I want to start photography." And I was like, "I got a pen. I want to write poetry." That same night, we both created a blog spot.
Nice.
And hers was like for taking photos. Mine was for poetry. And I mean, she ended up like skyrocketing. I mean, she shoots America's Next Top Model. Some of the top models would go to her to start shooting. She did magazine covers for weddings and all these things. And I got really into the poetry. And there was just so much life in it for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was this place where I could put to words for me. It was like a lot of this pain that I was trying to process from my family upbringing and not having any tools like at all. Pretty much relying on alcohol way too much and falling into this very, I was taking on this archetype of a heartbroken poet. Like something about that was really attractive to me. And I was in these poetry classes at school and I remember the teacher being like, "This should be your major." And I felt so seen. Like to this day, that's one of the moments where it was one of the first times I really felt seen was when my little poetry teacher pulled me after class and said, you should get a master's in this.
Wow.
And I went home, where I'm like, you know, I left the building so happy, and I told my parents. And then they kind of freaked out. They were like, no, you are not doing that. What are you going to do with that? You're not going to make any money. You know, we're getting you into college. Like, we did this. And so then I ended up being in the English department just because it's more versatile and wouldn't really have even mattered, because I think I would have ended up doing what I do today no matter what.
Right.
But it was such a beautiful place for me to put so much. There's just so much that had no place. Where do I put so much? I don't know where so much goes. And then it went into the poetry, and it's just, I'm feeling inspired. I'm like, maybe I'll go back to writing some poetry.
Exactly. I mean, where would that pain have gone if you had not expressed it through your poetry? Like, it's that could bottle up inside of you and then explode.
Exactly.
And it could come out as anger or rage because it's suppressed emotion. That's what I'm saying. It's like it is a healing modality. It's not therapy, but it is therapeutic because you're excavating the inner world, and you're exploring the world of felt sensation, and you're taking all of the data that you've accumulated from your experiences, and you're alchemizing it into poetry. So you're turning the darkness into beauty.
Yeah.
And that's alchemy. That's magic.
Work the magi.
Yeah. So what a gift to yourself and to others to transmute those emotions into writing. And release it from your system. You know, it's like I equate it to a subconscious purge or to an emotional purge, in the same way that you can go into a sauna and sweat out your toxins, right? Just it leaves your system, and you can go and drink plant medicine and vomit out different energetic or spiritual ailments. But writing and creativity is a similar process. And it doesn't even mean it needs to be great poetry, because like when you sweat in the sauna, you don't worry about how pretty the sweat is.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a role for creativity as commerce or as a product, but that's not the primary motivation of writing and creating. There's a therapeutic value to the expression. So I believe in extracting the capitalism from the creativity. And it's great if artists are in a position to make money from their work, and they should be rewarded financially for doing so. But I feel like so many people are held back from creating because they don't feel like they're talented enough. And there's no point in creating if they're not going to be published or famous. And no, there's a lot of value to creation that goes far beyond just making money. So
yeah,
I think that there's a role for both.
Yeah, and even though at the beginning of this I was talking about a little bit of my like struggle-ish with the self-publishing too. Also, there's always self-publishing. Like, I just want to say how amazing that is. And it's something that gives me a lot of comfort, too. I don't regret self-publishing Artist of Love. I'm so grateful I was able to do that, because even though, you know, the best of both worlds of like getting a traditional editor to give me that experience, and then like freedom to publish the book exactly how I wanted, with the cover I wanted, at the timing that I wanted, and you know, receive all the money for it, you know, and didn't have to go anywhere else. So it's so many beautiful things about that. And we live in a time where whatever you work on, again, like I love what you're saying about separating creativity from capitalism. And if you ever feel like, all right, I want to put this out into the world, you can.
Yes.
You can.
Yeah, I think I love the idea of moving past our institutional gatekeepers.
Yes.
That that appoints certain people as being credible and certain people as not, you know, especially now, you know, the publishing world is, you know, it's a little outdated. You know, things are happening so quickly with social media, and you can really have control over the means of distribution like never before. So I don't believe in seeking validation from institutional gatekeepers. Like, I'm grateful my work has been published, and I'm grateful for the publishers that have, you know, chosen to work with me. But I think that taking back the means of distribution on social media through self-publishing and no longer relying on these kind of outdated institutional gatekeepers in any field, I think it's the spirit of creativity is going to find a way to get itself out. And when the work is good, it's going to shine. So I wouldn't worry about how much validation you're getting from publishers or from record companies or from TV production studios or whatever it is. Put your work out there anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Validate yourself and believe in your work enough to put it out, and people will find it. Your audience will find you.
I love that. It's a beautiful note to complete on, except for I would love to ask you some quick fire round questions that I'm going to make up on the spot.
Love it.
Okay, the first one that came to me, because I don't know, it just feels really important, is if you were a fish, what type of fish would you be?
Wow, I've never thought about this before.
I know, it's important.
Are dolphins fish? I mean, dolphins are mammals.
They are mammals. I will allow it, though.
I mean, dolphins are cool. They because dolphins communicate and they talk and they have language.
Yeah.
So as a writer, I would, you know, maybe the fact that dolphins use intelligence and language to communicate, and they seem also a little bit like enlightened beings to a degree.
Definitely.
So I'll take a dolphin.
Okay. I love that. Yeah. Good answer. If you had any other life, like any other life, you were in the FBI, you were a mother with 10 children, living in Costa Rica, any life at all that wasn't the one you live now, what would it be?
In any period of time?
Yeah.
Let's see. Any other life in any period of time.
And this is your answer today.
Today.
That alleviates some pressure.
Yeah, maybe like some kind of a secret agent. I don't know. Maybe I think it could be fun to be a spy and, you know, infiltrate something and get information and do some covert operations for a good cause. That could be fun.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, why not? It sounds creative. It's like you've got to be playing a character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure.
High stakes.
Very high stakes. Okay, if you had a sit down dinner with your favorite, or you don't have to say favorite, but with two specific artists,
yeah,
who would they be, and where would you go? What restaurant would you go to?
What restaurant? I'd go someplace casual, just because I like to be casual and like just go someplace that's chill and laid back.
Like Odd Duck casual, or like Chick-fil-A casual.
No, I'm thinking like a coffee shop or something. Like, have you been to Radio in Austin?
I have.
We go to Radio because they have a big lawn.
That's good.
You can get some drinks. You can get some coffee. You can get some tacos. Mm-hmm. Lots of outdoor space. You know, just something like that. Super chill.
That's a good idea.
So I think Terrence McKenna would be one. Terrence McKenna is like he's a writer, and I would really describe him as a psychedelic philosopher. He wrote about psychedelics, but really what is great about Terrence McKenna is his lectures and his talks. You know, he died like 25 years ago, but yeah, his YouTube lectures are just iconic because there's no greater linguist that I have come across. Like, his ability just to talk and tell stories, and just his deep insight into the world and his philosophy is just so multifaceted and psychedelic that it's just, you could listen to him forever. So Terrence McKenna would be one. And then I'm going to say Walt Whitman, who is kind of like the foundational American poet. And he's more than a poet. He's been described by some as like America's Buddha. Like, he laid down a philosophy that was kind of at the beginning of America. And it was this, like, beautiful, accepting, inclusive philosophy that was not religious, but he was channeling divine inspiration through his poetry. So that's my favorite art. My favorite artist things that's like, it speaks to divine inspiration, and there's a deep reverence and sacredness to it, but it's also devoid of religious connotations. So it's kind of like this naked human spirituality that recognizes the human as innately holy. Mm-hmm. And these are sacred vessels that God uses to, you know, to speak through. So why not have him around too?
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great.
You can, and then Madeline Moon would be the.
And then me, I'll be there.
Yeah.
Sounds great. I will have a cocktail out there on the radio lawn. Okay, my last question for you. Mm-hmm. How are you an artist of love?
How am I an artist of love? I mean, well, love is the most important thing, first of all, you know, and even like, because love is so important just for how we show up in the world and our friendships. And, you know, I've just learned in the past few years that the importance of friendship and of showing love to others. Like, I love telling my friends that I love them. Mm-hmm. You know, I just love to be an example of that love. And the more I give, the more I receive.
Yeah.
And like, I couldn't, like, the relationships I've built on social media and in real life have been the most valuable things in my life. Mm. Absolutely. And they, and I'm held up by my friendships. Mm-hmm. And I'm held up by them because I also hold them up. So there's just this, I used to be more of a lone wolf, you know, and I still can be a loner at times, but having deeply rooted relationships that are mutually beneficial and supportive, and not being shy about showing love to our friends and to our loved ones is just, has meant everything to me. Mm. So that's what artists of love means to me.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love that. And I agree. I think maybe I'm a little late to the game, but it seems like community now more than ever is like, oh, it's here. It's arrived. And I do think I've been late to the game, but realizing the deep value of community and finding those people, really.
You're right on time.
Right on time. Yeah.
We're both right on time.
Right on time. James, thank you so much for being here today.
Such a treat, Madeline.
This was amazing. Everyone, go get The Art of You. Look at this beautiful cover. Look at James's beautiful jacket. Can we all just appreciate that?
Speaking of beautiful jackets.
Yes, we.
May I present you Madeline Moon.
We did it up today.
She looks like she's in The Great Gatsby or something.
We totally match completely. We need to acknowledge that. I like woke up this morning and I was like, I bet he's going to wear this color. Yeah. So we were right on.
Well, Madeline, I love you.
Yay.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for being here. If y'all enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe. We would love a 5-star review. It's like the currency of iTunes and Spotify. And you can also watch this video on YouTube if you listened on audio. And I just can't wait for another episode. Thank y'all for listening, and we'll see you in 1 month.